KALW.
It's a deep kind of grieving. It's a deep kind of sadness as we experience the destruction of the place that we know as home.
Tending to our mental health can be tough when it feels like the world is on fire.
We know that the climate impacts have greatest impacts on people who don't have access to power, who live in poverty, people of color.
Today, we dig into the psychological impacts of climate change. Then, the history of one local wildlife haven.
One of the turkey vultures, her name was Minnehaha. She would actually hop down and land on the handle of the rake, and then she'd start picking at your fingers.
Stories about taking care of ourselves and the natural world. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. It's summer here in the Bay, which for some means a hike in the woods, reading in the park, or taking a swim in the beautiful outdoors. Research shows spending time in nature is good for mental health because it lowers stress and improves our moods. But nature itself is under threat of becoming diminished as beaches submerge, forests burn, and unbearable heat covers more and more of the globe. Just last week, we felt higher than usual temperatures around the Bay Area. Livermore hit 111 degrees, topping its previous record of 109 from the year 1905. So one question is, as climate change intensifies, what will our mental health look like in the future? July is Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're going to hear from psychiatrist Robin Cooper on how vulnerable populations are disproportionately impacted by this crisis. Cooper works at UCSF and is co-founder of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. They call for psychiatrists to do more to prepare for the impact that climate change will have on our mental health. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Dr. Cooper in 2020.
You co-founded an organization that's looking at preparing the psychiatry industry for climate change. What issues did you notice that made you feel like it's time to act?
I've been involved in climate issues for over a decade. But as I got more deeply involved in the political arena, I began to learn much more that climate crisis really is a health crisis, that the climate impacts that we're having are massive threats to a whole range of health issues. And as a psychiatrist, I'm also a physician. But as I got more deeply involved in the health impacts, it became clearer and clearer to me that there was an extraordinary absence of psychiatrists speaking out and knowing and understanding the psychiatric impacts of climate change. We know that the climate impacts have greatest impacts on people who don't have access to power, who live in poverty. People of color have the most severe impacts of climate change, both heat impacts and disaster impacts and air pollution impacts. And we know that that's exactly what we're seeing with COVID.
Yeah, I interviewed an Oakland City official recently, and they told me that lack of trees in urban areas can cause warmer temperatures. But I read an article where you projected what's to come for our mental health as the environment gets warmer. Can you share some of those projections?
Heat is the most significant weather-related event that causes death and morbidity, trouble, health impacts. But in the realm of psychiatry and mental health, heat has increase in violence, that has a huge impact on domestic abuse, on violence against women, and I am very worried about that in terms of child abuse. We know that there's an increase in suicide rates that is directly related to increased heat. There's also an increase in depression and depressive language. There's impacts on sleep, and sleep impairments has wide impacts on your mood and also on thinking. And we know that with increased heat, you don't think as well.
I want to ask about water rising. I want to look at an extreme example. You know, I mean, parks that we go to now that may be gone in the future, neighborhoods may be gone, you know, islands washed away. What's the psychological impact of that, of just not having access to land?
One of the first communities that's being displaced en masse are Native indigenous population in the bayou of Louisiana. And they can't live in their homeland. And that's going to be happening all over the world. And that sets off issues of mass population displacement. Where are people going to go? How are they going to get there? So the impact on your psychic well-being and your experience of being connected to the place, the earth, that we have known as our home has huge implications. And there's this fancy word that addresses that. It's called scolophagia. And the word encompasses the idea of the loss of solace in the place that we know as home. It's a deep kind of grieving.
And again, as you said, this is not just going to impact people in rural areas. This is going to impact those of us who live in the cities, too, as well. And, you know, you talked about how you went to the mountains, you know, because the chaos of COVID is happening. I go to the beach to relax, too. And I'm very open about having anxiety and depression. And when I see that beautiful blue water and I hear those birds, my anxiety just drops. Why is nature so healing for us?
The sounds of water have a particular impact on calming. We know that the smells of outdoor and the views have a very, very healing quality and are very useful in managing both depression and anxiety. And those are big concerns about how we're going to be able to bring those into our lives as we face this very profound changing world.
How do you see the industry in the future when climate change hits? What do you hope are in place?
Well, wait a minute. When climate change hits, climate change is already, we are feeling it.
Oh, okay, let me backtrack. When it really hits, when it hits even harder.
But you've done something that I said that people want to do. It's not here, it's off there in the future, it's not there. So the field of psychiatry and psychology and health all have to look at this at multiple levels, at what do people need in their individual health sphere and getting at the roots of the causes of this. And that is, for us around climate change, our deeply dependency on fossil fuels. So moving to a clean energy system, and that's one thing that there is a lot of mobilization around. And I will say, in regards to mental health care has to be funded in what we call parity to general health care. And so whether that is health care for all in some form, and that it not be tied to employment, are all issues that we have to face.
So I'm thinking about people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and we know people with mental health challenges live 10 years less than the average population just because they don't have access to information on preventable diseases and preventable health issues. So what about them? How will they be affected?
The severely mentally ill are one of the most impacted population in terms of impacts of climate change. They die 3 times the rate during extreme heat. They're hospitalized much more during extreme heat. The medications that we use have a direct impact on difficulties in maintaining the body's temperature. We need a much more robust community mental health and public health system.
I know you said that facing the future, recognizing that is happening now, that will help us go forward. Can you expand on that? Because as you know, a lot of us are in denial. We don't want to talk about it.
This is something that is intruding and happening in our lives now. But what we do now can make a difference in how severe the future will be. I don't think we're going to come out of this smelling roses. There will be changes in the way the world is, But we can tolerate the deep anxiety about it by connecting with other people, by engaging in direct solutions. And by so doing, we will be able to have an impact on how severely the climate impacts actually are.
That was Dr. Robin Cooper speaking with KELW's Janae Darden in 2020. You can hear more of our mental health coverage at kelw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Speaking of nature as a refuge, Oakland is blessed with a lake in the middle of the city. There's 3 miles of path around it for people to walk, jog, and ride bikes. On the weekends, people picnic and barbecue on the lawns. They play drums under the pergola and row boats in its water. At night, strands of white lights strung between lampposts light up the lake like a tiara, the crown jewel of Oakland. But the Lake Merritt that we know today actually started as a wildlife refuge. The first in the country, before Yosemite, before Yellowstone. KLW's Marissa Ortega-Welch brings us that history.
There are so many fun stories that you can tell about Lake Merritt. There's the fact that Fairyland is said to have inspired Walt Disney, that Huey Newton lived in a penthouse on the south end of the lake. Sly and the Family Stone posed for an album cover on the Lake Merritt Monster Playground by the bandstand. You could really tell the whole history of Oakland through the stories of this lake. Some of my personal favorite stories, though, come from the Nature Center on the north side.
I can remember as a helper down here going in to clean those cages out in the morning. And the owls were always a little skittish. You'd have to make sure you didn't get the owls too excited or they might actually come after you.
This is Jim Cavell, who had one of the coolest summer jobs as a kid. He helped take care of the animal enclosures in front of the Nature Center on the shores of the lake. There was a coyote, a talking raven, a golden eagle.
One of the turkey vultures, her name was Minnie Haha. She would actually hop down and land on the handle of the rake. And she would just kind of walk up the handles till she got to your hands, and then she'd start picking at your fingers. And, you know, so you'd drop the rake and she would hop off and she would go after your shoelaces and start untying your shoes.
Jim's dad, Paul Cavell, was the acting naturalist at Lake Merritt's Rotary Nature Center from the 40s to the 70s. In those days, when people found injured or unreleasable wild animals, they would bring them to Paul.
We got a call one day from Disney Studios asking if we'd be interested in a sandhill crane. You know, a sandhill crane can stand 4.5 feet tall. So I remember as a teenager, pretty much just we would look each other eye to eye.
Jim's dad was basically like Dr. Doolittle. Any animals that couldn't be kept at the Nature Center, he brought home with him.
You know, the bats in the water heater closet and the skunks that live behind the refrigerator and the raccoons on the laundry porch and...
You had bats in the water heater?
Yeah. And then they'd be, you know, nice house bats because you never see them.
Your dad didn't really leave his work at work.
No. And it wasn't work. It was a way of life for him.
Jim's dad, Paul, is thought to be the first naturalist to be put on a city payroll anywhere in the country. And he worked for the nation's first wildlife refuge, Lake Merritt. So it's a lake of many firsts. Also, it's not a lake. It's an estuary where creeks coming out of the Oakland Hills meet with the tide coming in from the San Francisco Bay.
Wherever there's fresh water and salt water that mix together is where our ancestors really created homes.
This is Karina Gould. She's the tribal chair and traditional spokesperson for the Confederated Villages of Lisshan Ohlone. She says up to the late 1700s, there were 2 Ohlone village sites at Lake Merritt. There was tule grass and ducks and fish.
I could imagine that people would be on the lake in their tule canoes that there would have been fishing that was happening there. There would have been playing music. They would have been playing games. They would have been looking for food.
But in the early 1800s, the Spanish government seized the land from Corina's ancestors and gave it to one of its sergeants, Luis Peralta. In turn, some white Americans seized the land from the Peralta family. Soon, the marsh was dotted with the mansions of rich homeowners. One of those people was the mayor of Oakland at the time, Samuel Merritt.
Dr. Sam, I call him. Probably just me calling him that. But Dr. Sam would, he lived right up the street, kind of near the McDonald's, which obviously wasn't there.
This is Dorothy Lazard, head librarian at the Oakland Public Library's History Center. She says by that time, the marsh wasn't the most beautiful place to live. The city dumped its raw sewage there, and when the tide went out, it stank. So Merritt got this harebrained idea. He bankrolled damming the estuary to keep the tide from going out and turning it into a desirable place to live.
They called it Merritt's Folly. People in Oakland called it Merritt's Folly. It's like, who's going to move near here?
But it worked.
So already by 1878, they were calling it Lake Merritt. So it didn't stay a folly for very long.
As for how it became a wildlife refuge, the story goes like this. Merritt got tired of the duck hunters in his backyard. A stray bullet went through his window. Another one killed his neighbor's cow. He got the city to pass a resolution banning duck hunting. The resolution went all the way up to the state government, making it the first public wildlife refuge in the country. On the one hand, you can see this as a triumph for the birds, the start of a tradition to set aside and protect habitat. On the other hand, you could see all of Merritt's projects as really great real estate marketing.
If you look at old real estate ads, it's, you know, move to the lake. You have this Mediterranean climate. You have view of the hills. You're close to the central business district.
Regardless of the goal, the outcome was that Lake Merritt became a place for the birds.
This is an old picture from 1923, the annual Duck Festival, which was held at the lake. Where, you know, people would dance around and the ducks would fly. It was very bizarre.
If you're the kind of person who would attend a duck festival, this would have been like Lake Merritt's Renaissance period for you. The city started a daily public duck feeding program and built islands in the lake for bird habitat. In the 40s, Oakland became the first city to hire a naturalist, and that job went to Paul Cavell. The Rotary Club built the Nature Center, and Paul oversaw all the programs there, including banding birds to study their migration.
My job was usually, because I was small and quick, I could grab some of these ducks and bring them out to the folks that were doing the measurements and putting the bands on.
Banding helped scientists learn that ducks who spend the winter at the lake fly north to Alaska and Canada in the summer. Lake Merritt was one of the only places on the West Coast studying this in the 40s.
I think we had a snow goose that was banded here that flew over and was actually shot by a hunter in Siberia.
But maybe you're not a bird lover. Maybe you're actually afraid of birds.
You all right?
Yes, I think so.
What happened, Mitch?
Gull hit her.
A gull?
And maybe that fear of birds comes from one movie in particular.
All at once, the birds were everywhere.
Alfred Hitchcock actually sent a movie crew to Lake Merritt to film footage of gulls for his horror flick, The Birds. Jim Cavell remembers how a couple of the animal keepers at the Nature Center stood on the shore and threw fish into the air to get the gulls to dive down, footage that was later superimposed into the film.
Tippi Hedren is out there ducking and dodging, and they were actually gulls from Lakeside Park that were just trying to grab a fish.
While Jim and I take our walk at the lake, we notice one of the big bird cages he used to clean is empty and fenced off.
Slowly closing down more and more parts of this park.
In more recent decades, the Rotary Nature Center has fallen on hard times. The cages where Minnehaha, the turkey vulture, and the raven and coyote lived are gone. The enclosure where scientists used to ban birds is still there, but it's now filled with resident Canada geese and pigeons. Some of the changes here, Jim says, are a sign of the times. It's no longer acceptable to feed wild animals or keep them in small cages. But some of the changes are due to lack of resources.
You know, when I walk around the lake today, it's this part of the lake and the programs that were connected to the waterfowl refuge, they're showing their age, and I always feel a little sense of loss here.
The city of Oakland hasn't dedicated funds for park maintenance since 2005. It's been dipping into the city's general fund to pay for services while costs have continued to rise. The Oakland Parks and Rec Foundation called the state of Oakland's parks a crisis. Decades after Paul Cavell retired, community groups expressed concerns of mismanagement at the Nature Center and neglect of the resident birds and reptiles that remained there. The city closed the center in 2017, citing disrepair. Volunteers relocated the animals. The center reopened last spring, and so a few weeks ago, I went to see it with Terry Smith.
Do you mind giving me a little tour first? Sure.
Terry is the president of Community for Lake Merritt, a friends group that worked with the city to reopen the Rotary Nature Center.
It's more sparse than before, but it also looks sort of cleaner.
Oh, yeah, they completely gutted the inside and painted everything, and it's a new floor, and we went through all the old taxidermy. A lot of it was in kind of bad shape.
When the city closed the Nature Center, Oakland's Parks and Rec hired a consultant to undergo a community engagement process and then made a strategic plan for the Nature Center. Terry's group is now partnering with the city to implement those plans.
The first phase was just getting everything cleaned up and sorted, and now we're looking at building program and activities and things going on. You know, it's step by step. Things in the city are slow, but we're moving forward.
Other community groups and individuals I talked to expressed concern that the city wasn't moving fast enough and wasn't prioritizing science education. I asked Nicholas Williams, director of Oakland's Parks, Recreation, and Youth Development, if his goal was to bring back the same kind of education and science programs that Lake Merritt had during Paul Cavell's era.
Absolutely. Part of our overall goal for Parks and Recreation is to reintroduce Oakland's kids to nature.
And it's starting small. They've hired two part-time naturalists, and programming there is starting to ramp up again. Jim Cavell says that's certainly what his dad, Paul Cavell, the original naturalist, would have wanted to see.
And my father was a just steadfast believer that people in the city needed access to nature as well. It was a key part of their life, and nature is all around in the city if you learn to look at it that way. And that was a big part of his life's work.
In Oakland, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa first reported that story in 2020. Since then, Dorothy Lazard retired from the Oakland Public Library. Nicholas Williams also left his role in Oakland's Department of Parks, Recreation, and Youth Development. And unfortunately, in September, the Rotary Nature Center was damaged by a fire. It suspended operations for now. Tune in Monday morning at 11. From Barry White to James Earl Jones, Black men's voices have meant comfort, affection, and authority in pop culture.
Even though Black men, and men in general, can struggle to express emotions, I think that our voices, Black men's voices, the character of the voices can often, and the animation in those voices can often express things that maybe words alone couldn't.
An ode to Black men's voices on an episode of The Stoop tomorrow morning at 11. And before we say goodbye, here's some music from a local band. This is the band Present. They'll be playing in San Francisco tonight at Bottom of the Hill. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hussein Khan, Arun Nair, Julia Haney, Nigar Ajayabi, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.